The recording has started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the 42nd GNSOE PDP team meeting taking place on the 5th of February 2019 at 1400 UTC. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the telephone bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Thank you. Anyone else? Hearing no one further, we have listed apologies from Cavus Aristov, GAC, Alan Greenberg, ALAC, Giorgio Salentis, GAC, Esteban Lascano, ISPCP, and Emily Taylor of the RRSG. They have formally assigned Raul Goslin, Holly Raish, Chris Lewis-Evans, Fiona Asanga, and Sarah Wild as their alternate for this call and any remaining days of absence. During this period, the members will have read-only rights and no access to conference calls. Their alternates will have poaching rights and access to conference calls until the members' return date. As a reminder, the alternate assignment form must be formalized by the way of the Google Doc. The link is available in the agenda pod to the right, as well as the meeting invite email. Statements of interest must be kept up to date. If anyone has any updates to share, please raise your hand or speak up now. Seeing or hearing no one, if you need assistance updating your statements of interest, please email the GNSO Secretariat. All documentation and information can be found on the ePDP Wiki space. There is an audio cast and view-only Adobe Connect for non-members to follow the call. So please remember to state your name before speaking. Recordings will be circulated on the mailing list and posted on the public Wiki space shortly after the end of the call. Thank you, and this, I'll turn it back over to our chair, Kurt Pritz. Please begin.
Thanks a lot, Tari, and hi, everyone. I hope you're well today. We have quite a few items to cover on the agenda that don't exactly go to the substance but are really important to our discussion. So let me start with them. And when we get through with the when we get through with the welcome and the updates, I'll pause for a minute to see if there are any other adjustments to the agenda that are in front of you. Sorry. The very first thing is sort of a recent development. So I think Rafiq might have just sent you an email that we got from Keith. So we've been working with the GNSO and ICANN to extend our deadline a little bit in order to, which might be good news for you or bad news, and in order to provide some time for us to, you know, from myself a standpoint, to settle some outstanding issues if we can, to make our report as complete as possible, and second, to provide a little bit of quiet time for review and consideration of the report and, you know, to make the quality of that report the best it can be. So in that email, I can't say I've been working with the board and talking about different timelines and things like that, and from sort of a high level view said that, you know, it seems to us that an additional 2 weeks would be fine. What Marika and the team have done in anticipation of that is work out a somewhat different timeline. So I think, you know, since this is the new news, we should go do that first. Unless there's questions, Marika, are you prepared to, you can take a look at the letter we got from, not we, but the council got from ICANN, if you want. And more importantly, here's kind of how we think the rest of our working time before the delivery of the final report should go. Marika, do you want to take the helm? There's a bunch of lineups,
sure.
So you have to pay attention to that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sure, Kurt. So, indeed, what you see up on the screen is basically an updated version of the timeline that I think we originally shared with you, I think it was probably only last week or maybe just the week before that. So what has been stricken out is basically the meetings that we've already had and the items we have already covered. So where we're currently at, and I'll take you there in the document, is, of course, yesterday the deadline for flagging topics for further discussions based on the latest version of the final report. And we have another meeting here today. The small team group will meet, the data element small team will meet later today to continue on their work. We have additional meetings scheduled for this week, including a meeting tomorrow, as well as a legal committee meeting. And then I think as originally planned, we hope to circulate a final version of the final report that basically hopefully addresses all the kind of open issues that we still have by Friday this week, which would also then be accompanied with the latest batch of items for the consensus call. And the idea would then be to submit on Monday basically a placeholder motion for council consider of the report, as well as the latest version of the final report to the GNSO council for consideration, but making clear that this is not necessarily the final version yet, but that some additional time is being provided, what we've labeled here as quiet time, for the EPDP team to review the final report, socialize it with your respective groups. I think it's important to emphasize that the idea of the quiet time is not about reopening previously closed issues or question previously reached agreements, but the focus should really be on, are there any issues that were overlooked? Are there any inconsistencies in the documents or any errors that we didn't spot before, and also an opportunity for you to review the consensus designations as an overall package in the context of the full report. The GNSO Council has already scheduled a special meeting on the 14th of February, so that would be an opportunity for the EPDP team leadership to brief the Council on the version of the report as it stands, of course, making very clear that some further updates may be made as a result of review that's ongoing in relation to the quiet time. But it would also be an opportunity to outline indeed the next steps and plan delivery of the final version to the GNSO Council. And again, it's an opportunity for the Council as well to already ask any clarifying questions they may have or any concerns that they might see. So then at the end of that week, so the 15th of February, that would be the end of the quiet period. So that is your deadline for flagging any issues that were either overlooked, inconsistent, or an error, or flagging any disagreement that you may have with the consensus designations. And so based on what issues are flagged by that deadline, we've currently foreseen two additional meetings on the 19th and 20th that would allow for ironing out any of those items that would require further discussion. Obviously, there may be some items that are flagged that are mere updates to the report that may not require conversation, but we do want to plan in some additional time that allows for further conversation, which would then lead up to the production of the final report. So again, that is either an updated version of the original version or a confirmation that the version that was submitted on the 11th of February is actually the final one, should no issues be identified during the quiet period. Then there are two council meetings that one of which has already been scheduled, and I expected the 4th of March one would be scheduled following that, which is the 21st of February meeting. It's the council meeting that's already scheduled, so that would be a first opportunity for the GNSO Council to consider the final report. And my expectation is that would only happen if the changes that are made to the final report are fairly minor. But if there are more substantive changes that might require the council to consider, have some more time to consider the final report, then there would be a special meeting on the 4th of March that would allow for that adoption. I know that Stephanie asked the question on the public comment period. So this timeline doesn't yet include the next steps, but basically as soon as the GNSO Council would adopt the final report, The next step would be that it's published for public comment prior to board consideration. So that is really a public comment period that is for the board to consider. It's not something that comes back to this group to review or opine on, but it's really an opportunity for the board to kind of review and assess, you know, the broader community feedback on the report. In parallel to that, the GAC will also be asked to identify whether there are any public policy considerations that the board should factor in as it considers the report. And those two parallel tracks would then lead up to the moment where the board is in a position to consider the report for adoption. So that is in a nutshell the proposed timeline. You're factoring in the little additional flexibility that has been provided as a result of the letter that was sent by Jorn Marby in relation to when the board would need to receive this report in order to meet the 25th May deadline. So I hope that makes sense. Happy to take any questions or suggestions people may have.
Thanks very much, Marika. Two features of this I'd like to point out are, one is that we still plan to share a version of the final report in the near future and, before it's done. And I thought about that quite a bit and think that's okay. The purpose of that is for us to really take the GNSO Council through the final report and show them how it's constructed and how to read it and where to find stuff so that when they get the final report, they'll sort of be able to more hit the ground running. So I think it's good to keep that step in there as sort of a time saver training exercise. I'm sure we'll point out, which recommendations seem to be settled and which ones are, or at least which ones are still under discussion, but we'll certainly avoid a substantive discussion of any of those at that point. But I think that's a worthwhile exercise. And then, second, from the School of Sneaky Management, I just want to let you know that I've been told not to say the words quasi-quiet or semi-quiet period, but if we do see an opportunity to make progress on some issues where they were formally not making progress either because we've just received legal advice or something like that, I'll respect the quiet period greatly, but we'll try to move some things forward during that week too. That was born out of the request of some of you to build some time in for consideration the report, and also with the realization that we have our troubles, but we're like the well configured group that's knowledgeable about GDPR here at the right time and the right place to settle these things. So we should take advantage of all the work we've done to try to get as far as we can. Are there any questions about that? Great. So thanks, Marika. Thanks for your active participation on the mailing list on many of these issues. I think the email conversations have been pretty good. We're ready to discuss some of those issues today. I think, the deadlines we put in for regard to raising certain issues or commenting on edits to the report has gone by. So where I think we are now is that we're continuing the email discussions on the items that are raised. Maybe we can knock a couple of them off today, and we'll move to closure on as best we can on those outstanding items. As everybody knows, I obviously agonized over that email about the consensus calls. So I hope you I hope it was clear to you. And if you have any questions about that, you can ask them now or later. Obviously, in those first two bundles of recommendations, we try to pick out the ones where, you know, we were able to say, you know, either in Toronto or before then, you know, going once, going twice. So we had agreement on the room on that set of purposes for processing data and recommendations. And in bundle three are the recommendations we're working on right now. So I think it's important to know where we stand to complete those, to see if you agree with my assessment on those sets of issues where I thought we had agreement. I think we should hold to the timelines I suggested. So if there are issues, we raise them quickly, but I'm hoping not. And although hope's a really bad strategy, isn't it? And I had one more thing to say about that, but it's gone away. So I think that's all the updates I have. I'm kind of looking at the staff to see if there's anything else. Margie, go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you, Curtis. Margie, regarding the consensus call, I raised this on the last call. We feel that the purposes alone is not a sufficient area to look at for consensus because there are other recommendations that are linked to it, in particular recommendation two regarding the additional work that's got to be done. And so is there any way we can take a look at the consensus from the perspective of REX 1 and 2? Because, frankly, if there's no consensus on the first one, or the second one, then we don't agree with purposes without having the access, recommendation considered alongside it. So our suggestion is that the consensus be looked at in connection with recommendations one and recommendations two, since those are fairly closely linked. If that's something we could consider. And then my second request is regarding the timeline. Can we have an additional day to identify topics, given that we've got an extension of 2 weeks? We just didn't have the time to work through the entire final report.
An extra day for what, Margie?
For identifying the additional topics that was yesterday's deadline. We just ran out of time. There's so much back and forth on the list and work done that we couldn't get it all together in time for yesterday.
Okay. No, sorry, too bad. No, that'll be fine.
Kurt, this is Thomas. Just to let you know, I've joined only on the phone a couple of minutes after the hour. And I will stay as long as I can, but I have to jump on a train so the connection might get lost. Sorry for...
All right.
Thanks
for letting us know. And if you want to get in the queue, Thomas, just speak up. Margie, to your second thing, I thought about, unbundling the purposes and trying to match them up with later recommendations. And I guess I decided not to do that because it seemed cleaner this way. And, to me, these are areas where we have agreement. So I hope your concern is unfounded. And so I think the best way to do that is, I'd be happy to, this isn't an inflexible thing. So I'd be happy to take your agreement with the assessment on consensus and condition it on something else. So, and certainly, certainly there's going to be kind of a gestalt, kind of a consensus kumbaya thing at the end. So it's not such an it's not such an inflexible process that you can't condition one or on the other, or if the eventuality you discussed took shape that you couldn't raise your hand and say, hold on there, we need this. So I understand what you're saying, and I think we can address your concerns in those couple ways. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, Margie. I don't want to set things in stone. No, I agree with you, and I'm in front of everybody here. You'll have that capability. Okay, and then so. In trying to get this done, we'd like to schedule meetings. So there's currently one scheduled for Wednesday, which is tomorrow, that I'd like to keep. I know but it's problematic in that there's an RYSG meeting at that time, and I don't know what other obligations people have on Wednesday or what attendance we'll get to have. So my recommendation to the support team was to keep the Wednesday meeting on the schedule. We could break for, say half an hour if the RYSG guys are happy with jumping off this call and jumping on their call, because I know there's discussion around there's a lot of discussion on important topics. There's an update to be given and other things. So, I would suggest we have a meeting for, say, an hour tomorrow, an hour and 15 minutes. And then let the RYSG guys go, and then maybe or maybe not come back. So let's at least have that. And then to kick off our quiet period, we're going to schedule a meeting on Monday. That'll be fine. So we'll schedule a meeting for Monday too. And what I recommend. Mark, please go ahead.
Thanks, Kurt. Mark Anderson. I'm wondering what is it you're hoping to cover tomorrow during this meeting? We're still planning on having the Thursday call, I assume, and then on next week, do I understand that you're hoping to schedule a Monday meeting instead of a Tuesday meeting? Or is that in addition to the Tuesday meeting?
No, that would be the only meeting for the week.
Okay, I guess Monday, but I'm wondering, what the differences between starting the quiet period immediately following an ad hoc Monday meeting versus starting the quiet period after a Tuesday meeting during what would be our regular time slot. Is there a particular reason for that?
Well, we have, even with the extension, certain deadlines for submission of documents that we're trying to work to, and Monday's that date. So we're trying to meet that. From what you're saying, so first, let me answer your first question, and that is, we think that, we're not going to, I don't know if we're going to get to completion today on the transition mechanism, and also on the agenda we have a few other topics that are added, the substantive topics that have been discussed on the email list. So I'd like to talk about those. Actually, the list I was working to an item 5 was longer, so I had up to 5 things there. So we have many substantive issues. If what you're hinting at with Monday Tuesday change is that you think others might be unavailable at Monday because you schedule your life around these things. That's understandable too. So I'd like to get feedback up from the group on that. But you know, I'd still propose we have a Monday meeting instead of a Tuesday meeting, so we can go into the rest of the week and be quiet. I know it's no comfort, but nobody wants to have another meeting less than me. So you're talking to the only guy that feels the same way and feels his hands are that it's a necessary thing. But let's see how far we get, and then we'll today, and then we'll make a final call. Ashley, please go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is potentially a rather dense question, but in terms of the things are just moving so quickly in terms of the next handful of meetings that we have or may not have. Could you just briefly, I mean, I don't need a full-on agenda, but just an understanding of what those meetings are intended to achieve. I know I'm still kind of anxious to see the resolution of the remaining recommendations, but just for the sake of, you know, making sure we're on the right calls and knowing what's going to be discussed, an idea of what you intend to cover would be helpful.
Yep. So, one issue that was what was raised while you were gone is an implementation transition period. So that is the fact that in our policy will require some implementation discussion that's likely to extend past May 25th, so that we need some mechanism for providing a set of rules to operate by during that interim period, and there's been a couple recommendations for how to go about that. And the ICANN board and the GNSO council are keen for us to make a recommendation on that. So that's one item. And then, you know, items for us to discuss further are the things that are on the email list that were put out to close out. So reasonable access is an issue. Recommendation 10, which is email contacts, been discussed on the list. The research purpose is still open but coming to a close. Geographical indications, privacy proxy issues, and I think that's it. Maybe there's one more. So it's really focusing on the open issues. And then also, finally, we've got some feedback, a final report where we're trying to parse the input between substantive change and correction or non-substantive change, and any topics that come up from that need to be discussed with the group. So that's the list, about five or six open items, the transition period, and then comments to the final report. I say it really fast, it doesn't seem like a lot. Great. I'm looking at the support team and seeing if there's any action items or any other update issues before we go into the more substantive part of the agenda. Go ahead, Marika.
Yes, thanks, Kurt. This is Marika. If I can just remind people, as we indeed extended the deadline for flagging issues for further consideration, if you know, indeed substantive issues or what people think there are substantive issues, if those can go on the mailing list, so you know, people can see them and you know, potentially already react to them. And any, you know, minor edits, corrections, please use the Google Doc for that. I'm happy to circulate the link again if people don't have it handy. You can also find it on the Wiki page where the different versions of the final report are posted. And also a reminder, if you are referring to specific sections, please use the line numbers in the PDF version of the red line version. So we're making sure that, you know, we're looking all at the same thing. Thanks.
Thanks, Merkin. And I think, you know, I'm not one for making speeches like this, but it does good to take a step back and reflect on the work that's been done here, you know, starting with, you know, the decision, you know, I think we're led by Thomas into this, but decision to that we would, you know, analyze each of the data elements and their flow and how they're processed. And then, you know, that exercise grew and grew and grew until it's a pretty formidable piece of work that we have backing up our conclusions. And the fact that we've struggled is a strong word, but struggled through, you know, the set of recommendations we have so far that are, I think, really meaningful. And so, you know, it's easy to forget about the quality of the work that's been done so far. And, you know, I think that's a basis for trying to finish up these issues that are important. Thank you, Farzi, for that point. So with that, I'm going to turn my – we want to talk about the implementation transition period, and I'm going to turn my head gently to the contracted parties to see if we can get a hand raised on what we think the current state of play is here and if there's any updates to what we last discussed. Thanks, James. Go ahead.
Hi, Kurt. James speaking. I'll throw myself at the mercy of the crowd here, and hopefully one of my colleagues from registries or registrars will jump up and rescue me. But just generally, we've had some conversations, and I think the good news is, I mean, for this group, that they all circle back to some of the proposals that we had at the tail end of our meeting in Toronto, where we discussed a time period, you know, whereby compliance would, whereby compliance would enforce either some elements of the temporary spec. We can't call it that, of course, because it will expire, or the new policy. And that would allow contracted parties a period of time to pivot from the old to the new. I think that the reason I'm a little cautious here is that we still haven't achieved 100% sign-off from our constituencies on the exact language, so we're kind of still circulating that and poking it with sticks, but I think we should have something to present back to this group shortly. So it is moving forward. It was the subject of a call earlier where we're trying to get all of our ducks in a row. And but I think it fits with the new timeline, and it fits with what we discussed in Toronto. And that's probably the most substantive update I can provide. But I would welcome any additions from some other folks. Thanks.
Anyone else? Oh, I see the clock is taken down. Mark Anderson, please go ahead. It's okay with me if the clock's on.
Kurt, hi. This is Mark Anderson for the transcript. I don't have anything to add directly to what James said. Thanks, James, for jumping in there. I do want to add, though, I'm looking at the letter from Joran that was provided to us just now. And, you know, I'm noting that sort of the 2 extra weeks are conditional on the phase 1 final report, including policy mechanisms or policy recommendations on the bridging mechanism, my word, not the word from the report. Paraphrasing here, or like reading from the letter, provided that the final report includes policy recommendations for the initial phase of the policy, the time period between 25 May 2019 and the time needed to implement the full set of policy recommendations. So just sort of noting for everybody that, having some kind of bridging mechanism, is sort of a prerequisite on getting additional time. So I want to note that for everybody that we really do need to have this mechanism in there, and that it's referenced in Yorin's letter there today.
Thanks. So I want to take a couple minutes, I guess. One is, James, not to put you on the spot, but anybody shortly is a vague term. I think that there's going to be some level of discussion or debate on a proposal when it's made. And so, we're all waiting for somebody to nail 95 theses to the door, but it's really if we want to have a quiet period, it's really imperative that we close something off in the next day or two, or at least have a proposal on the table, that you might not be able to completely sign up to because you might be getting the response of your stakeholder group. And then second, given James' comment, if anybody else has any preliminary thoughts on form, that would be fine too. Thanks a lot for raising your hand, James.
Yeah, Kirk, James speaking. Just to commit to, we can have something here, I think, in the next 24 to 48 hours, the latest version of the language. And again, I'm very behind on my emails. But the latest version of the language seems to enjoy a broader and deeper level of support than we've seen in the past. So I think we're there. So we'll get something out here shortly. Thanks.
Thanks. Anybody else want to comment on this issue? Okay, great, I guess. Thanks very much. Let's go on to the work that's being done on the Data Elements Workbook, which is truly a small team because it's a dedicated bunch that has been looking into this. And I think it's been Mark, Alan Woods, and Alex that have been doing a lot of the work, aided by a couple others. So we really owe them a debt of gratitude. They meet for 2 hours after each one of these meetings, which, I have trouble staying focused on. But the work and the detail they're paying to this is great. So I'm going to turn the floor over to Barry Cobb. And he can include the members of his team as he wants.
Thank you, Kurt. Barry Cobb for the record. I'm actually going to be turning it over to Mark and Alan to provide the update. But for the most part, Mark will talk about kind of the general approach that we've taken in the small group. Eds will give a high-level overview of the split of Purpose 1 into 1A and 1B. I think you'll have noticed that purpose statement split in the consensus call package. And then also they'll talk a little bit about the minimum public data set which has now been migrated into Purpose 3, but they'll talk a little bit more about that. So, Mark, please go ahead and let me know if you need any help.
Thanks, Barry. Mark Anderson for the transcript. I've been asked to start things off, so I'll try and give sort of a brief overview of what we've been doing. But just by way of background, you know, one of the you know, the registry stakeholder group comments and was that you know, we hadn't really done all the work to go through the worksheets from start to finish. And you know, I think as we were getting ready for the initial report and in the rush to make the deadline there, you know, we sort of went with what we had done up till that point. But I think you know, hopefully among everybody, there's a recognition that that there was work that still needed to be done on those worksheets. And you know, once again heading into this this final report, you know, deadlines sort of crushed us, and we ran out of time to deliberate this as in the full plenary, and so we had this small group formed to go through or to take on the task of going through each of the data element workbooks, making sure everything in there was accurate, make sure it reflected what we had discussed and agreed to in the plenary, and make sure it was, you know, consistent with the purposes and, you know, and processing activities for each of those purposes. So that's sort of you know, where we ended up or how we ended up having this small group discussion. Barry's got up on the, or I guess in Adobe, we've got a list of the data element workbooks we've been working through. We agreed in Toronto to the Purpose 1 split, and so having that broken out into a 1A and 1B, and the workbooks provided by the registry stakeholder group provided sort of the starting point for us, and we went through and deliberated on those. You know, purpose two, of course, is the purpose for third party access, and so we got through the discussion on that one. You know, at a high level, the you know, that workbook focuses on the fact that we're not doing any processing activity specifically for the purpose of providing access. You know, all of that processing activity has to be done for another purpose, and that purpose two is for providing access to data already collected or processed for other purposes. So I think we've got that one updated to, you know, accurately reflect what we discussed in the plenary. And I think, you know, if memory serves, where we left off, you know, it was, you know, was a large discussion on three. And Barry alluded to this a little bit in that, you know, purpose three is, I consider purpose three the contactability purpose. And, you know, purpose three is really, in a lot of ways, it's the purpose why you would have an RDS in the first place. You know, if you don't have purpose three, your justification for having a public directory service is, you know, really goes away. And so for having an RDS at all, purpose three is really important. And so here we went through and, you know, and looked at, okay, what's the information that's, you know, collected, transmitted, disclosed, and also you can see on there, there's redaction as well. And so there's the publication, you know, we also, I should say, and this is maybe something, Alan could get into in a little more detail, but we got into the difference between disclosure and publication, you know, publication being sort of a subset of disclosure. And that was sort of a fine conversation about what we meant by disclosure and publication. But it was also one of those discussions that it was good to have and important as far as fleshing out the details for this workbook. and just sort of a level of detail and discussion that we didn't have a chance to have up until now. And so this is, this is the result of where we are with Purpose 3. And again, I think this is real important because it gets to the basis for having a public directory service at all, and also the one that covers where redaction occurs. So that's important to take a look at and review. I'll mention one other thing, and that's, as we've been going through this, one of the things we talked about that would be helpful would be sort of a single, sort of a single summary. We've got these data element worksheets that, are tied to each of the purposes that we identified, which was fine for our deliberations. But one thing we talked about that would be useful to have in the final report was a complete listing of the fields, and so sort of a single roll up of all the data elements. I don't think that's something we've gotten to. I don't know if that's anything Barry's been working on at all, but that's one of the things we were talking about that would be useful to include, and probably a conversation we'll be having after today's meeting as well. I think I'll stop there, see if anybody has questions or wants to add to what I put.
Thank you, Mark. Alan Woods, would you like to briefly touch on Purpose 1A and Purpose 1B and the split that occurred there?
Sure. Thanks, Barry. I was looking at how power tools are just being used within the room at the moment that I started talking. So apologies if you can barely hear me. I want to add one or two things to what Mark said there as well, which occurred to me as he was speaking. So thank you, Mark, for that. And I would just add, one of the things that we did actually have to go into as part and parcel of our work as well is, and Mark actually did touch off it, was the concept that we really needed to define as well what the specific headings were, the collection, transmission, disclosure, publication, things like that. Can't hear me. Is that better? Can people hear me now?
This is Kurt. I think it's fine, Alan, and I turned up the volume on my headset.
Sorry about that, guys. I'll go a little bit back then. What Mark had been talking about was with regards to the definition of disclosure and publication, and that was one of the things we needed to do as well. And we went and we looked and we've given tentative suggestions as to the definitions of what the individual processing actions are as well. So that was kind of important that led us trying to identify the proper data elements and for each element of that. In addition to that, another thing that Mark said, very important, is that when we are defining what is a minimum data set, we are not talking about a minimum data set for the entirety of the purposes. We're talking about a minimum data set for each purpose. And that is very important, that each purpose must be looked at in isolation of each other because we can't think of, we use X data elements that's collected under Purpose 3 in order to apply to Purpose 1. No, they have to be individually thought about as an individual purpose, the data elements that are required for that individual purpose and limited only to that individual purpose. Now, there will be overlap, absolutely. Huge amounts overlap, but we must think about it in that line. So when we're talking about a minimum data set, remember we're talking about per purpose. So Now I'm going to jump in and talk about purpose 1A and 1B. I won't take very long on this. God love poor Barry and the crew got an awful long-winded version of 1A and 1B when I introduced this. And thanks to Barry for, you know, giving clarity as well to what we had done on that. So the important thing with 1A then is, as we discussed in Toronto, there is a huge difference between the technical aspect of the activation of a domain and the allocation of a domain, and then the ensuring that the benefits of the registrant are being able to be enjoyed by the registrant, subject to the terms and conditions of the registry and obviously the ICANN policy itself. So we needed to necessarily, looking at a minimum data set, break the two of them together, or break them up, should I say, because the minimum data set for 1A is actually relatively straightforward, and that is specifically that you need the domain name, obviously, you need the name servers, and in certain instances, you may also need the name server IP address as well. And there's this whole concept about a specific name name server that is within the zone that you're trying to register a name on, and we won't get into that, it is described. But it is a very straightforward and similar, or very straightforward set of data that is required under the activation. So that's, we're looking at what ICANN requires specifically to activate a domain. You're talking about RFCs and a technical specific set of actions that is necessary. So 1A is a very, very small data set. And then when you compare that to what is contemplated under 1B, that is a much bigger data set. Because, again, in trying to give the specifics, so again, that is the conferring the benefits to the registrant, but also subject to the terms and conditions of the registry, the registrar, and ICANN consensus policy where necessary, you would need potentially a transfer of data elements such as the registrant data as well. Because again, in say an AUP was a limitation that there was an AUP violation or something like that, well then the registry may need to contact the registrant directly. So they're going to provide the registrant data from the registrar to the registry in order to, you know, where it is a legal basis and there's a justification for that transfer as well. So you will see also that we put that down, however, as being optional. And now this is probably something that has spilled over into Recommendation 5 as well. I think it's Recommendation 5. And it is an interesting one, and that is that the minimum data set for 1B is including registrant data. But, and this is where it gets a little bit like, you know, as Shrek would say, the layers of an onion, that there are instances where registries may not necessarily need that registrant data set. It is still justifiable under, you know, the legal basis, or the legal basis, and it is justifiable. However, certain registries might suggest and might believe that they do not need that data in order to fulfill their own business needs, their own business models, or indeed their own legal interpretations of the obligations upon them. So it is not a required, it is an optional. So we have to, when we're going through these individual data elements, it is so vitally important that we take into account this sort of a concept. And that is why you will find under 1B that the registrant data is not down as required, but down as optional, where there are registries out there who might not need it and are perfectly okay not to need that. But that should not affect the minimum data set, which is justifiable and linked to a specific business purpose that would be communicated to the registrant at the collection of that data by the registrar. So, it's not clear-cut, and this is why we wanted to put a lot more data into this and a lot more thought into this, because this is things we hadn't really thought about, and this is what made it very difficult for the registries. And apologies that it took us so long to get this, but it is a very complex teasing apart of what is necessary versus what is justifiable, while taking into account things like privacy by design and, of course, necessity and justification. So that's what we've come up with at the moment. We will continue to work on it. And again, thank you to Barry for the inordinate amount of work that he's put into this. I'm finding this time is not the best time for me, and I'm finding it difficult to be able to attend these things. But they are working exceptionally well. I just want to thank everybody for the help. I just see Mark wants to jump back in, so I'm happy if people have no specific questions about Purpose 1A or Purpose 1B, I'm happy to pass back over to him.
Thanks, Alan. Mark, again, I see getting the go-ahead from Barry in chat, so I'll just jump right back in. Alan mentioned optional there at the end, and that sort of triggered my memory. I forgot to talk about one of our major topics of conversation from last week was around optional, and I see we've got that up here in Adobe. So thanks for pulling that up. I think we've stumbled upon this problem in the plenary discussions as well, and certainly this came up again in sort of our deep dive on the worksheets. It's the fact that the word optional alone is not sufficient for the work we're trying to accomplish here. Optional by itself doesn't provide enough specificity on what we need. And so we spent a bit of time, I think it was on Thursday, trying to dive into what we mean by optional and provide a little more specificity. I'm trying to read as I go. We've got a legend here. We've got optional for registrant to fill in, but if supplied, it must be supported. The name server is a classic example, if you will. The name server is simply, it's not required for a domain registration, but it's the critical component of the service that a registry provides. It's optional for the registrant to provide it, but it's mandatory for the registry to support it. That's what that first one refers to. The next one on there is optional for the registrar to provide, but if supplied, it must be processed. Here I think what we're trying to get to, I think the example we used last week was phone extension. Many people don't have a phone extension, but from a contactability perspective, if you do have an extension, you would expect that to be provided. I think that little nuance there was what we were trying to accomplish in that second one. And that third bullet there is optional for contracted parties to support. This is a field, feature, or functionality that is not required for the registry or registrar to provide. Generally, we would include this while optional to provide, if they do provide it, we're stipulating that it be provided in a certain way. That optional, I think, generally has meaning there. I think this is something we've stumbled over a couple times, we spent some time last week trying to get a little more specific in what optional means and how we're using it, and hopefully that will translate into a report that's a little more clear and easier to agree on what is meant in there. Just adding that to what I said earlier. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. I don't think the rest of the team has anything to say other than what was placed into the chat. So, Kurt, if no objections, I'll turn it over to Hadia, and then you can take back over. Thank you.
A question, a clarification question with regard to the data elements of purpose, for example, 1B, which speaks about the nameholder exercising its rights. While the nameholder could exercise these rights by delegating the rights to an admin contact or a tech contact, by delegating it to professional people in his company or outside of that. So I was wondering, there was no reference whatsoever. I know we haven't agreed yet on including such fields. However, I'm thinking, I just wanted to ask, so you did not include any of these fields. Are those fields pending to redecide on whether to include them or not? Or do you think they don't belong here?
Thank you, Hadia. I see Alan and Sarah typing into the chat. I'm not sure that I understand the full context of the question, but perhaps it would be good if you could email that to us and we can discuss it in our small team call later today. All right. Thank you, Hadia. Kurt, back to you.
Great. Thank you very much, you guys. And thanks for the additional work. Barry, how can, how can they keep up with the work you're continuing to do? What's the best way for those that want to sort of dip their toe in and review without getting sucked into the maelstrom?
Thank you, Kurt. I posted a link to the wiki page that houses all of the data elements, workbooks, prior versions, etc. I think you really only need to pay attention to the first two rows on the wiki, but that contains the latest versions of NXD and the updates, our proposed updates that the small team has made. Also, there's a section on the wiki about meetings if you want to go back and hear any of the recordings. That'll probably bore you to death, so I'd really just recommend reviewing through the latest Annex D, and it might be, right now I only have the red lines posted, so it might be helpful when you take a look at that to just review it without any of the track changes so that you can see where we're at. As I mentioned in the chat, we have purposes 1, 2, and 3, and 7 mostly done, a little bit of cleanup on 3, and then today we want to hopefully get through 4 and 6, and then lastly will be to essentially kind of run through the entire document to increase the consistency on the rationale statements that are provided for each of the purposes, as well as the lawful basis designations for each of the processing activities. And we'll update that based on where the current recommendation sits in the final report that was derived from the legal advice that Bird and Bird had sent to the group.
Great. Thanks, Barry. And thanks a lot, Alan. Thanks a lot, Mark. That was really well done. And thanks, Alex, too. I know you're on all those calls. All right. So let's get to the substance, another substantive part, and that is the email discussions we're having on the various issues. So I think the first topic we'll discuss is the topic I think that Alex brought up, which is privacy proxy services. Yep, that's good. And we have two sets of language. And So let me, my perception of this issue might be incorrect, given what the email said. But in order to sort of shortcut the discussion and get to the heart of it, you know, my perception is that, a proxy registration is not personal data, and so it seems to me that that should be published. But there's a debate about an important debate about the email address and whether how that should be handled. So, the debate may be broader than that. Alex, you brought up the issue in the first place, so thanks for offering to kick this discussion off.
Sure, Kurt, and hello, everyone. This is Alex. Yeah, so just to first of all, thanks everyone for the active discussion on the list. I appreciate that. I just thought I'd kind of step back a little bit. As I understood it, the original intent of the language in Section 2.6, I think, of the TEMS Act, and also of this new proposed recommendation was really a pragmatic one that avoided a situation where privacy proxy data was behind the gate, right? The update proposed by Alan, again, I appreciate that and thank him for that. It puts us in a situation where privacy proxy data can be redacted and is thus subject to reasonable disclosure requests and all of that and all of that entails. So when this is the case, at the end of a potentially very lengthy process for not only the requester but the responder, which could, we hear, take up to a month or even more, the privacy proxy information is simply returned, and essentially we're back to square one. You know, I understand, you know, my goal was to come up with language that allows us to avoid that situation, because I still assert that it's not good for anyone involved here. You know, I understand that a pseudo-anonymized email address can be personal information, but given all of the rest of the data associated with a privacy proxy record is associated with the service itself and not the individual, I think the risk is low. But the benefits, I think, are pretty high. So I just wanted to tee that up and kind of focus on, you know, the reason for, I think, the original temp spec language in my attempt to move that into a recommendation. Thanks.
Thanks, Alex. And so I'm going to try focus on this. You know, whenever you discuss costs are minimal and benefits are high, that gets me into a sort of 6.1.F. kind of analysis, and I think then if we're in that 6.1.F analysis, what we're saying is the proxy registration data is personal data, and I think it's not. So maybe Alan Woods can help me out here, but you know, I think the proxy data is not. So we don't have to get into the balancing, and James will help me out too. Okay, great. Alan, go ahead, please.
Thanks very much, Kurt, and thank you as well to Dalek as well. And absolutely, I mean, I take everything that he said on board, and I can see where he's coming from on that. It's just one of those situations where we need to be very, very clear on the impact that we are having and the risk profile that we are trying to create here. For the registrar, let's be honest, because it probably wouldn't filter down to the registries in this. So I'm kind of putting on my pseudo-registrar hat here. So the problem here is that pseudonymous data is not anonymous data. Pseudonymous data, if it can be linked or capable of, with other data, identifying the registrant is still personal data. Now, there are varying levels of risk associated with that based on what is the public availability of the other data that could potentially identify or see behind the pseudonymized data. I know that there has been a good discussion between Aidan and Hadia and others, and Alan Greenberg as well on this. And, you know, the important thing here is that we need to be able to assess what the risk is here. And we're saying that with pseudonymized data, as certain PMP providers do provide pseudonymized as opposed to anonymized data, and there are both out there, that we need to be clear that if it is a pseudonymized email address, then simple things like going to the actual website itself might be able to identify who that registrant is. You're linking an email address, which doesn't look like the original email address, I'll give them that, but it is still an email address for that person. So it is capable of identifying that this email address equals this person. And I mean, that for me, straight away, I'm like, we run into an issue at the first hurdle. It is very, 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 very important. And I know my audio is crap today, so I might actually, after talking here, reconnect. But it is very important that people need to understand that we're not saying that this is a no full time, but I just think that this is something that is outside of the scope of the EPDP at the moment. There is a problem with the privacy and privacy provider setup at the moment, potentially, so the GNSO should probably look into that. We cannot change the way that these are set up and the way we are expecting them to set up. What I will say as well with regards to what Alex was saying, he said that there's no reasonable disclosure request for that, which is not true at all. There absolutely are reasonable disclosure requests available for that data. Number two, chances are it probably make more sense to go to the privacy and privacy provider, you know, to do that. But again, this is not our call. It is something outside of our remit. But I just want to give a little anecdote as well, perhaps to help with this, that the vast majority of requests I have received as a registry operator to date have been for ones that are currently behind privacy and privacy proxy provider services, and which are currently very obvious from the WHOIS output. It's just that the requesters aren't bothered, they're barring to check the WHOIS output. They just blanket give me the request anyway. You can see it's a PMP provider, and yet they still request. So I don't know where the benefit is. I'm using that word. I would just ask Alex as well, to whom is this benefit you're talking about? Because we're talking about the controllers and the processors here. We're not talking about third-party benefit. If you're talking about public policy and a public interest benefit, well, then you really need to look at, you know, Article 6.3 and say, well, under what public benefit are you talking about? Where is it in EU law? And to whom is it for? So, you know, this is a non-starter of an issue. I understand where you're coming from. I think if you want to be reasonable in this, we can make it a may, that a registrar and registry may publish. I think Alan Greenberg in his last email, and I pointed that out on the list, actually said, well, make it at the option of the registrar. And I don't think I have a problem with that, because it would be under the controllership of the individual registrar themselves. So that's where I see this issue. I think a may would be fine.
So here's what I don't understand, and so this, and maybe James can answer my question, and this might be a gross misreading of what's going on here, but my understanding is that the recommendation asks for the return of the proxy data, which is not personal data, except for a debate we're having about the email address. So is that true? And if that's the case, why wouldn't the registrar return the non-personal proxy data? And then we're debating narrowly about the email. So that's what I don't understand. Anyway, James, please go ahead.
Thanks, Kurt. James speaking. I've been following this discussion online or trying to on the list, and I have to confess that I'm a little behind on that, and I also couldn't hear everything that Alan Woods was discussing, so I'm probably more responding to you and to Alex. I just wanted to, and maybe I should have raised my hand sooner and teed off the conversation with this point, is that we have to be very careful of painting these services with one brush. sometimes a privacy proxy service will establish a separate legal entity, and it is effectively a transfer or an assignment of the domain name to that entity as the registered name holder. And sometimes it's simply providing contact information relay between the registered name holder and the contact information provided by the service. And sometimes it's, you know, there's all kinds of shades of gray in between, and then there are probably models that I'm not aware of or that haven't even been deployed yet. So I want to be careful when we say, well, this is true of this, you know, the services do this or they operate like that. You know, I just want to be careful that we're being a little too over generic when in fact there's a whole spectrum of the biodiversity, I guess, of services, the way they're modeled and the way that they operate. I hear Alex Deacon's concern that, you know, hey, if I follow the recipe, you know, that is TBD in phase two for disclosure, you know, I don't want to jump through all of those hoops and then at the end of the process end up with a privacy or proxy service responding to me as opposed to the actual underlying beneficial user. And I get that, and I think as a provider, I think we want to automate that process to the point where, at least for the most vast majority of cases, it doesn't happen that way. But I don't know that we can bake in a guarantee in this particular policy that's going to assure that that will not happen for all possible implementations of the service. And so I think I'm trying to kind of put an overarching concern on the table that we're trying to boil the whole universe into a very small box here, and I'm concerned that that doing so not only restricts innovation and restricts the all the different ways that these services can operate and can serve different markets, but also will not yield the outcome that we want, which is this kind of this guaranteed and deterministic outcome of never seeing a privacy service at the end of a disclosure request. Now, to the point about email, I think what we've found in terms of implementation guidance is that if we associate a single email with a single domain name, whether that elevates it to personal information or not, I think is a subject for, you know, considered debate. But the bottom line is that that's useful for spammers. That's just as good as having your email address, particularly if it's a blind relay and there's no filtering involved. But essentially, we've just assigned an email address that is a direct link to another email address. I know some services will randomly regen a random string and associate it with the email so that it's constantly being refreshed. That's one possible way to address this problem and maybe further push this down the anonymous end of the pseudonymized spectrum. But again, these are all implementation changes and things like that, and I think it's really important that we think of how this plays out for the customer who is essentially enlisting this service and paying for this service for the purposes of having this additional layer of privacy. And I would caution us against taking a broad approach to dilute the value of that privacy service, because honestly, what it'll do is it'll just set up or incentivize, I think, additional layers of proxy for those folks who truly do want to protect their privacy. So I don't know if that helps, but I just want us to think a little bit more abstractly about this when we consider all of the services that could be impacted. Thanks.
So James, or anybody, understanding that, you know, writing this policy in a certain way might not address Alex Deacon's concern 100%. Is there a way to fashion the policy so it addresses that issue 80% of the time? So I'm getting at different models that registrars have implemented or may implement in the future, and some of those models, you know, might contain personal data in some way because of the different shades here. So is there a way to fashion this so that you know, that information, that indication that it's a proxy or privacy or some other service is returned 80% of the time, and to help them with that issue. And is that, you know, that the registrar will return all non-personal data or something like that?
Kurt, this is James. Did you want a response, or I can get back in the queue?
No, a response would be great.
So, James speaking again, and I think the answer is that similar to the temporary spec and the currently work in progress PPSAI policy, what they do is they essentially require that each of these services first off identify themselves and then also provide some mechanism for legitimate and lawful folks to request the underlying contact information. And so I think, you know, if we can build a process here that captures, let's say, 80% of the cases, and then those individual services are required to disclose, to publish a process for catching, you know, maybe not the remaining 20, but let's say the remaining 18%, you know, I think that marginalizes those scenarios where there's absolutely too many hoops to jump through. And I understand it. I mean, to Alex's point, it's like, you know, you get to the end of the map and you kind of have to start over at the beginning. And I would say, well, I would hope it's not exactly the beginning. It's just a different process and a much more expedited one-on-one communication. So that's just my thought, and it is already required as part of the temporary specification of the 2013 RAA.
Yeah, exactly. Kurt, if you're speaking, you may be on mute.
Sorry, Mark. I unmuted myself and then muted myself again. So for the third time, thank you very much for that, James. I'll think about that. We should think about taking your comment and beating up this recommendation somehow. Mark, go ahead.
Mark Slazarek. I'm sitting on the queue because I wanted to make a similar comment to what you were making, Kurt, about, you know, what is the distinction of proxy? Isn't proxy just the name of the, you know, the legal person service that's providing this? But in the end, I wound up with just plus one. So plus one, thank you very much for explaining that distinction. I never understood why these two things were lumped together. Now I do. Plus one for acknowledging that the topic of whether or not pseudonymized email turns into personal data and under which circumstances. Thank you for understanding the other point of view. And plus one again, thank you for recognizing where this exists within the temp spec and the RAA and being open to developing additional language to beef this up for the 80% case. So thank you. That's it.
All right. Chris, welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chris, for the record. I just wanted to highlight on one of the points around the pseudo-anonymization of the emails. So, under GDPR, a lot of it is about reducing the data or the likelihood of being able to identify that individual, which, a lot of the examples are based on medical records and, you know, putting people in age brackets. And I think really the way that a lot of the privacy proxy email address allocations work are a lot stronger than the pseudonymization methods that GDPR sort of touches upon. So from a risk point of view, I think, methods that have been undertaken there, and as James said, that, you know, some do it on a per domain basis and some do it on a per registrant basis. So, I think the risk is just that slightly level lower with the methods undertaken by privacy proxy at the moment. So just I think that's worth taking into account. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chris. Amar, please go ahead. Do you have a recommendation for us?
Thanks, Kurt. No, this is Amar. I don't have a recommendation. And I raised my hand before James spoke, and I think he covered most of what I wanted to say. You know, not to take away any of the positions put forward on list on you know, pseudonymizables and whether or not they contribute to making a registered name holder more identifiable or not. But like James said, we need to remember that, you know, these services, privacy proxy services, exist to serve a specific purpose. And I don't believe that, you know, what we're trying to do with them here is actually contributing to us replacing the temp spec with a more permanent replacement, you know, with a limitation and scope in mind to just make it, you know, GDPR compliant. I'm concerned that we might be, you know, altering the nature of the service itself. And that is something that not only we should not want to do right now, but I don't believe is within the remit of this EPDP. This is something that would need to be taken on board by the GNSO Council and the ICANN community at large and in other discussions. You know, people use privacy proxy services because they don't want to be contacted directly by third parties. They want third parties to go through these service providers. And you know, publishing a pseudonymized email that permits direct contact is not something I think we should be entertaining at this point. I think James made the point a lot better than I did, and so I'll just stop now and see where we can go from here. Thanks.
Thanks, Amr. Hi, Holly. Welcome.
Thank you. I'd also like to thank James for the distinction, but point out that actually privacy and proxy services are two very different things, and if you go back to the 2012 report, you'll understand that they can be used as a substitute for agency or actually a service that provides privacy, and that means that they're actually implemented quite differently. So when we have a discussion about privacy proxy, that's actually recognize that they're very different things and they're actually addressed very differently. I also take the point that in terms of privacy proxy services, the privacy aspect of it, actually we had a lot of discussion at the time about how to protect the privacy of the individual, and I think that's been done, and in the discussion that's just been held, the email address is the one contact point. And it's just that. It's just contact point, and it's usually very well protected. So that's just a little bit more of the debate. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly. So, you know, I'm probably the worst position to recommend alternate language here, but is it okay to say at a policy level that the registrar is, you know, should publish, or maybe it's a must publish the non-personal data associated with the privacy or proxy registration, and so that would give an indication, and that would give the registrar, you know, there's implementation questions to be answered there, as James says, that can be worked out, but that would provide the mechanism by which the registrar could choose to indicate to the query that it's a proxy or privacy or whatever type of registration. Is that possible? So that's question one. And question two will demonstrate how far out of my depth I am, but you know, and question two has to do with mail and contacting the registrant. And is that addressed some way in recommendation 10, which is about email, or you know, or is there you know, I'm channeling Alan Greenberg here, who's not in the meeting, but you know, is there some obligation on the part of the registrar to provide some sort of conduit to that through 10. So I guess those are my two questions. Could this recommendation be rewritten to create an obligation where the registrar publishes, you know, the non-personal data
that is part of this registration. So that would naturally include privacy registrations, proxy registrations, those data elements which are not personal data. And second, is there a way out of this debate about pseudonymized, I can't even say that word, email? Any comments to that? First, any comments about whether those sorts of things would address the issues, and second, why that's an inadequate or not acceptable way to do that. Yes, I just got ping. Silence is agreement. I'm using my keen ESP capabilities to detect it's not. If my questions were poor, are there any suggestions for a way out of that? Alex, please go ahead.
Thanks, Kurt. It's Alex. Yeah, I just want to respond to Amr because I think either I'm not understanding or something else is going on. The ask is not that we're asking to change the nature of privacy services. It's simply that there's an indication without having to go through a reasonable disclosure process, which I know is always an option, that a privacy proxy is being used. In the case, for example, where one can determine a privacy proxy is being used for a large registrar, we would not waste time in asking for disclosure. We would simply use the established process, by the service provider to request access for information or communicate with the registrant behind the proxy. So again, it's a pragmatic, if it's a pragmatic ask. If there's a way to know that there's a privacy proxy being used, it would be great to know it so we could avoid jumping through the reasonable disclosure hoops to end up in a spot where we would just find out that it's a proxy and we need to use a different process altogether. So we're not at all, or I'm not at all, arguing that we change the nature of privacy proxy. And I do think this is within the scope of the EPDP because essentially we're talking about who is data, RDS data, and an indication of whether this is a privacy proxy or not, I think would help all of us. Thanks.
Thanks, Alex. So I'll torch us for a couple more minutes. So James, you referred to the temp spec. So what this recommendation does in these two forms here is essentially replace the temp spec. The first recommendation posted here is probably mirrors the temp spec, and the second one changes it. So in your discussion, what were you recommending with regard to the temp spec where you said we have the temp spec? Okay, thanks. And what does that state? Sorry to put you on the spot. Hey, James, thanks.
Thanks, Kurt. James speaking. So you're going to test my memory here a little bit. I hope this won't be on the quiz. It says essentially that privacy proxy services that are affiliated with an ICANN registrar have to identify themselves, have to publish a point of contact for abuse and for law enforcement, and have to also have a process for folks to ask them to disclose the information for their customer. And the point of this was in the 2013 RAA, I'll throw ICANN staff under the bus a little bit because I think everybody that worked on this might be gone. But the point of this was they kind of came to us with a really baked policy, and we were saying, look, this probably needs to be a broader community discussion and a consensus policy. So we put this temporary policy in place with the idea that it would be a placeholder until we could develop a full consensus policy, and that full policy is the privacy proxy accreditation it's PPSAI. And so that is now complete. It's not yet implemented, so the temporary spec is still this Band-Aid that's still in place. And so so when the privacy proxy, PPSAI, goes into effect, then this temporary specification, temporary policy that exists in the 2013 REA will expire, and that will take place. So that's kind of when I said temporary spec, I wasn't referring to the one that we adopted last year. I'm referring to the one that's part of the 2013 REA and has been renewed a whole bunch of times and probably just needs to ride off into the sunset and be replaced by PPSAI. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm reading the chat. So, so I'm here, and I'm looking at this, and I'm sorry I'm not as quick on my feet as I should. But is there, from the contracted parties, is there any support to what I suggested? I see some words from a thing going on here that's improving the language, but I don't know if the base of the the base idea is acceptable, that non-personal data be returned, which I think would indicate whether there's a privacy proxy registration and also, to comply with GDPR, right? And so, Alan, to your question, I think that's why it's left up to each registrar to figure out the easiest way to do that. Mark?
Hey, Kurt. It's Mark Anderson. I was going to type this, but just easier to say it. It's not always known to the registrar if a privacy proxy service is being used. I think maybe generally privacy services are offered by registrars, but proxy services are not, and so they might not always know. Last time we had discussed this topic, we had also discussed language to the effect of, in cases where it's known that a privacy proxy service is used or something to that effect. It's been a while since we had that discussion, I believe we need some kind of qualifier there. I defer to the registrars on what makes sense, but there were some edits we put in here last time we discussed it that don't seem to be carrying through to this conversation.
Thanks. That's a great point. In a way, I think this sort of wording addresses that, because if it's an outside proxy service, say it's my attorney that's registering the name, and the name of his law firm or whatever would be personal data too. So I think it naturally would address that issue. But I also think that we could add a notation to make that certain. Alex, and then Margie.
Yes, Kurt. Yeah, I was going to suggest doing exactly that in. Somewhere buried in the email thread on this topic, I suggested that, to avoid a situation or the debate where we discuss who is and who is not a privacy proxy service provider and the whole issue with regarding lawyers or mothers that children that may register domains on behalf of their elderly parents or what have you, that we simply restrict it to affiliated privacy proxy services, those that are known to the registrar. So, for example, I would assume GoDaddy knows when their privacy proxy services is being used, and then would be able to simply, without any doubt, know and publish accordingly. And I assume other registrars would be able to do the same thing. And I think Margie, there's language in the privacy proxy policy, PPSAI policy that we could leverage. I think there's even language in the this temp privacy proxy spec in the 2013 RAA that we could leverage. And I think that's what Margie may have mentioned at some point. Again, the goal here isn't to complicate things or be difficult. It's simply to find a solution where when possible, it's known via a simple RDDS query that a privacy proxy is used, and that gives folks an indication of what path they need to walk down. Thanks.
Thanks. Go ahead, Margie.
Yeah, I put it in the chat. Alex is right. We already kind of negotiated that at the time of the 2013 RAA, yeah. So it seems like we should just stick with the language there. I put it in chat if you could take a look at it, but that's how it's defined in the 2013 RAA.
Thanks very much, Margie. So I'm looking at Sarah's, before it scrolls up, everybody look fast. So I think Sarah's language around this seems to strike that balance. No, just using the word affiliated. So I see Margie's comment about the 2013 RAA, but I also remember James' comment is that we were looking forward to dumping that language with the onset of or the finalization of PPSAI, and I'm chuffed that I'm making the addition of affiliated is the replacement of affiliated into Sarah's language gives me hope. Is there, and then with regard to the email issue, I'm very sensitive to that too. Is there a way of having that discussion in the context of recommendation 10, where we talk about how to contact the the registrant? So I think it's sort of a known privacy or proxy service. It's sort of already on the onus of the registrar to accept emails to some address and then find a way to contact the registrant. So, have the recommendation here as Marika's typed it with that one small change, and then have that email discussion under and the way of contacting the registrant under recommendation 10. Is that possible? And so what
No, I probably can't say that again, and because I didn't say well the first time, I'll just go down. I started out real slow and then petered out altogether. So, but, I see Alan's email, and I understand the issues, too, with web-based or web form contact, but that's a way that works. Yeah, I'm kind of agreeing with Stephanie also. So I see a lot of plus one Stephanie's, but I see, under how can we have this? I think these are separable discussions. One is about the return of this information in a way that alerts the seeker of the information to identify whether it's a privacy proxy registration. So. I think that satisfies the goal that Alex has. And I think that, to the extent this recommendation talks about this anonymized email, this pseudo-anonymized email, that, it addresses a concern that, depending on how registrars implement that, it may or may not lead to personal data. So for the purpose of this recommendation, I think we've satisfied Alex's need is too strong a word. And then I think we have to have the conversation about contacting the registrant under a different mechanism. I don't know if that's recommendation 10 or it's something else, but it's something, if web form is a way, I understand the issues with not getting a return that the email actually went through or didn't, but I think we should have that discussion in a different setting. I guess I want to hear from, So I'm going to let this discussion go. Yeah. So Margie, I think that this wording, satisfies that last need that you put in, and we had quite a discussion about email in Toronto. So, I think we're diving into on the email on the chat list. We're diving into next steps. So, Marika, if you could capture that. Wording. What we're going to do now is take a short break and we'll put that wording up at the start when we resume and say, this is the wording you're going to see in your email coming forward. So you can get prepared for that and possible acceptance of that. So does anybody have any more comments they want to make orally? So, Aidan, I think that which must not include any information which could reasonably lead to identification of a natural person. I think that's sort of the definition of personal data. All All right, so let's take a break. See you guys at the top of the hour, okay? And then we'll talk about two more things and then head for home. So thanks very much for this discussion. I think we got somewhere that was good. Talk to you soon. Hi, everyone. Hi, everyone.
Kurt, this is Terry. I heard you say something briefly and then nothing else after that. Just checking on your
audio. I said welcome back and then I paused. Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
I said welcome back and then I was giving everybody just a minute to get seated. So the next topic on the agenda is reasonable access. It's really important to some sort of agreement here. My reading on the email list is centered around the possible inclusion of a base response time. I think that's the primary issue. So I'd like to hear either from, I'm sure everybody's read all the emails, but I'd like to hear either from someone that proposed that we include a response time in the reasonable access, some sort of number that what the hoped for outcome is, this sort of a minimal hoped for outcome, and or from the side of the contracted parties or others that would state, what they might be willing to live with for that response time. So I think that's the prime remaining issue there. But if there are other issues with regard to that, I'd appreciate somebody take off the issue. What's the where's the current wording and see if this is if that wording is acceptable to all. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. This is Marika. Just to clarify what you see on the screen. So what you see on the screen is the original language that was circulated by Kurt, I believe, last Friday, I want to say. Or maybe Thursday, sorry. I don't know exactly when. And the edits in red line are those that were suggested by Alex on the list yesterday, which I think some of those are just clarifications. And I think one of them is adding a specific example that you see at the bottom of page two. So I think that's where your language currently stands. I think Aidan responded on the list. I know. I think that Aidan had to drop off and will be back shortly. And I think he indicated that he at least could live with it as a stand now, but we have concerns about any further edits or changes. But I believe that's at least all the input I think I've seen so far, and that is what is reflected on the screen.
So thanks for that, Marika. I'm really sorry I was on mute again. So I'm seeing the comments typed in by Christine and Amar. I wonder if either of those would be willing to elaborate on your comments a bit.
Amar, why don't you go ahead? Minor, I think, not as significant as yours.
Sure. Thanks, Christine and Kurt. Not sure how significant mine are, but I'll take a stab anyway. This is Amar. I'm just wondering if, from an implementation perspective, whether the issue of, responding to the school requests in the same time frame that would be provided to data subjects, I'm wondering if this would work, if it would practically work or not. Third-party disclosure requests require a lot more work in terms of, determining to what extent the disclosure request is reasonable, whether it's lawful or not. And these things, I'm guessing, would take time. I'm not an expert on how long that would take or what's involved. And, it might depend on multiple factors such as, the volume of disclosure requests being processed by a single provider at one point. So I'm just wondering if from a practical perspective, this would or would not work. If it does, I have no issue with it. If it doesn't, I just thought it might be something we might want to consider. Thank you.
Amar, could you please elaborate on what Article 12 GDPR timeframe states?
Let me look it up, Kurt.
My question might be off, but it seems like you're incorporating their standard by reference. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. The reference was in the document that you laid, Kurt, so that's why I put it in the chat. And if I'm not mistaken, the Article 12 timeframe was 30 days or a month. I need to find it. I recall that being the case. So yeah, the time frame similar to a data subject request was referenced in the document that was circulated. That's why I brought it up and raised the question on it. Thanks.
All right, and I think so. Sarah's cut and paste is really helpful. Marge, go ahead.
I'm looking at the language and I'm trying to understand how it fits into our purposes, since it doesn't reference any of our purposes. And there are disclosure requests that could be under purposes beyond purpose two. So, for example, the dispute one is the one that comes to mind. And so I'm just, is there some way that we, I guess perhaps in the request for reasonable disclosure, minimum information, we reference the purpose that we're seeking the information under, because that may factor into the analysis for disclosure.
Yeah, I understand the wisdom in what you're asking. If everybody else would think about Margie's comment and how that might be meaningfully included. I thought it was included in the second bullet here, but maybe you want it to be more specific.
Right, because we've obviously done a lot of work on the purposes, and so it seems like they should be linked in some way so that there's, you can easily reference whichever purpose you think is applicable to the request that you're making.
Yep. So I think that would be, a pretty easy fix. Okay, Christina, go ahead.
Yeah,
you know, my comments are more, I think, form driven, and I was trying to come at this from the perspective of someone who's never read it before, and I think there are a couple things that we need to fix because I think they're going to be really confusing. For example, we kind of bounce all over the place among reasonable access requests, reasonable disclosure requests, reasonable requests for lawful disclosure of non-public registration data, and then a reasonable request for lawful disclosure is how we identify the criteria. And I, you know, I'm happy to put a suggested red line to the list, but I think that's really confusing in using what are using different terminology to refer to what I think are supposed to be the same thing. And there are a couple points in here that I think need greater clarity. For example, you know, what I think under the timeline, the logging of requests, is that a requirement for logging, or is it supposed to be a timeline by which the requests are logged? You know, I just think that there's a lot of places here where we could really tighten it up to eliminate any kind of confusion and, frankly, speed up the work of the implementation team. Thanks.
Well, I'm certainly willing to take you up on your offer to do that. So thank you very much. And yeah, I don't disagree. I think consistency is really important in language and specificity too. So thanks very much. Margie, go ahead.
Sure. I'm really trying to understand the language here. What does it mean when we say 90 days? The must provide such reasonable access within 90 days of the date ICANN publishes such guidance. I don't understand where that came from, and it seems like 90 days people could misread it to mean, you know, responding to a request in 90 days, which I don't think that's what we're trying to get at here. Is it something that we deal with on the implementation side, or what's the thinking behind that language?
No, I'm reading it. Trying to find the beginning of the sentence.
Sure. And if Christina, yeah. She's saying that's from the 10th spec, and I think I had this comment in another place as well. I don't think those timelines carry over to us, given that the 10th spec's already in existence and you actually needed that, you know, when the 10th spec was adopted. I think, you know, the whole transition concept is something that I think is wrapped up in the work that James and the registrars are doing that they'll share with us. And so it came up also in another recommendation, and I sent something to the list about it. But that's, you know, when we're talking about implementation date from the temp spec, I think those need to be replaced by the overall implementation thingy that, you know, we're going to agree on shortly.
I'm just reading through the initial paragraph. Alex, please go. Well, Margie, well, I think about your question and others do too. Alex, please go ahead.
Thanks, Kurt. Yeah, another point I raised on the list that I just want to do again now is there seems to be some inconsistency in the temp spec language and the new recommendation language. Specifically, the temp spec language, as quoted above, seems to indicate that this reasonable access is only pursuant to Article 6.1F. But then in the body of the text, the statement is made that contracted parties will consider each request on its merits with regard to GDPR legal basis, which seems to indicate that any legal basis is applicable here. So I just wanted to restate what I said in my email, which is we need to somehow make those two consistent. Is this just 6.1F, a reasonable access, or can it be used where applicable by for other legal basis? So I just wanted to raise that point. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Alex. Data can be disclosed for any of the legal bases in Article 6. I wonder, from a policy standpoint, whether we should leave that open for any legal basis. I agree with Diane's language here. So, I think that I like the Stephanie, you're backtracking here. I like Amr's first recommendation and would incorporate that language that Sarah pasted into the chat right into the recommendation we have. So to use that exact language, and then I like Diane's idea of making the first paragraph a lot more clear. And so when it is clear, we'll have an answer to Margie's question, because I read that paragraph a couple times in the last few minutes and couldn't answer her exactly. So do that. And Christina, you volunteered to take some of this clarification on to the extent you want. I'm happy to work with you on it, or members of the support team, or however you want to take a first stab at that. So if you want to do that, that's terrific. And then, take that first stab at it. That's terrific. And then for items you'd like one of us or somebody else to look at in addition to the work you're doing to help you out with the management of your time, we'd be happy to do that. So with that incorporation on Amr's suggestion, I don't know if, we don't have time to wordsmith this here. It's too complicated. So is there a sort of general agreement in the room that would provide sufficient detail in reasonable access under at this stage of the game, understanding that we have implementation to go through, and then I think the access discussion too is gonna when a universal access model is developed, then the other forms of access that will be provided will have to be considered too. So I'm hopeful that this provides the right amount of specificity, and if it does, the overall satisfaction, then I think it's a significant achievement. I like the way, it's really good the way everybody thanks people for doing work, because there is I was going to say shitload, but I won't, but there's a lot of work that's going on with the data workbooks in this. So that's just funny to know that that's never lost on me. So let's talk about we're going to go on to another topic, and that would be additional purposes. So there's been some movement on the email list about that, and We'll just pause for a second to see how that comes up. We had a recommendation from Aiden on this, so we'll bring this up. And I think Aiden is going to come back in the next few minutes, but so long, Sarah. Thank you. So, I think in, Alan's not on this call either, so that's kind of sad, but I think is Benedict gone too? So that's kind of unfortunate. All the key players aren't here, but I think, it's kind of, I'll just say difficult situation that champions on this team that supported the creation of a use for research purposes, haven't found support for that by expressions by the ICANN staff. And so, but I'm really, in the conversations I have, I don't yet disagree with the need for such a purpose, despite those writings. And so I think what we want to leave open here is that if there is such a need that it can be addressed, so at least lay the groundwork so that if there's a future need, then that can be addressed too. So I'm repeating myself. So I think Aiden's insertion here is a good one in that he has identified a specific requirement. And I wonder if then we have some other way of opening the door to future requirements. Alan, thanks for rescuing me. Please go.
Sorry, I don't think I'm going to be rescuing you in this one. If we start talking about the future requirements, I'm straight away going to get my hackles up on this because we're talking about the way the data is currently being used. If a future requirement is to be developed, a future requirement is to have a data protection impact assessment as part and parcel of this, and it will be created at that point. If Opto have said to us that they don't currently need data, I think Aiden had made some very good points about, maybe talk about pseudonymized data. But I again, if we start talking about future needs, then we have failed straight away. We're talking about the current use of data, not future. So I just want to really, really make sure that we're clear on what we're doing here.
So, I'm sloppy with my word usage. So when I think about this stuff, I think about, in our recommendations, we're especially current data processing steps, and we're identifying where they're GDPR compliant, where they're not, and what steps we'll take to make them GDPR compliant. And that can happen on a routinized basis. And what I'm thinking on this research, what I'm thinking about this research purpose is that, at the time the request for data is made, it's not automatically granted because we have a purpose here, but, that research purpose has to be evaluated against GDPR and the and the legal bases. So is it a legitimate interest? Is this study a legitimate interest? Is there, is the data narrowly tailored to the purpose for which it's being processed? So the principles of minimization. So we wouldn't be creating a policy that says if ACCO or any other part of ICANN needs data for some purpose, then that's okay and we're going to grant it. But rather that, I think I'm saying the same thing as you're saying when you're saying data impact analysis, you know, that balancing has to be done so that we know that disclosure is GDPR compliant. And so, I'm channeling Alan, I think, by saying that, you know, if we state that somehow here, we'll be able to expedite that consideration some more. So, yes, I agree with you totally on we can't speculate on future uses and then just give them a blanket permission to access data or have data disclosed to them, but rather, you know, we would do that analysis to make sure it's GDPR compliant. So I think we're in agreement. I hope you agree with that. Margie, go ahead.
Sure, this is Margie. About the cross out of the anonymous accuracy reporting system, I believe that was related to the fact that we were lumping it into the compliance provision purpose. I forgot which one it is in our purposes. But my recommendation is that in order to ensure that it doesn't get lost, that we reference that in the purpose section, you know, so that it's not seen as though there's no place for the accuracy reporting system, but merely note that the purpose is intended to include accuracy reporting system. So with that, I think that would make this you know, cross out acceptable. And then the other issue I raised on the list was the issue of, I think it's, and you talked about it just now, you know, access for basically a threat response, and maybe that's not this. This is something else. But, you know, I don't know if we, you know, really captured or identified where that would be for ICANN. I'm not talking about third-party access. I'm talking about, in this case, ICANN. And so I think that's something we should talk about.
Okay, thanks, Margie. Yeah, so in fact, you're right. And, you know, I don't know where this email exchange occurred, but there was one that involved Alan Greenberg and the team that is reworking the data elements workbooks, the processing steps for the ARS supporting ARS is being included in that the element workbook as an affirmative disclosure of data for that one purpose under compliance. So, that's that. And, right. So, anyway, go ahead, Javier.
Okay, so 2 points, and maybe Margie covered some of it. So as Margie said, we had here the accuracy reporting system, and it has been moved to purpose 5, which talks about compliance. And we just need to make sure that this happens. And also mention it maybe in the purposes here. And then another thing, when we were discussing the research purpose in Toronto, we actually referred to the security, stability, and resiliency of the DNS, and that being a mission, an ICANN mission, and we discussed that this might require research. And this is why actually we thought about including the research purpose. Benedict, when we first introduced this, maybe he was thinking of mitigating risk through threats to the DNS. And rightfully, this is an ICANN purpose. How I can tell is this mission is another issue. And maybe we are not very clear on that. And that's maybe also why we need to make sure that we include the research purpose. Pending further information and investigation on how ICANN would carry on its research or its on whether ICANN would actually need this purpose for its for maintaining the security and stability of the internet and mitigating the threats and risks to the DNS. And what's being said that this is not happening now and we don't need to think about the future. Well, as a fact of the matter, the fact of the matter is that now the security and stability of the DNS and mitigating the risks and threats is an ICANN purpose and is an ICANN mission. And it does make sense that this includes some kind of the need for some kind of historical data. So we are not talking about actually things that might come up in the future, and that's why we need to take it into consideration now. We actually don't have enough information to decide on whether ICANN will need historical data or not. And that's why it's good to have this purpose. We are not saying that we are going actually to act upon it. We are just saying we are considering this. We need further information and legal guidance and information from ICANN. And let's investigate this further in phase two. So yes, I would keep this. And I think it's important to just refer to the Okta response, but I don't know why we need to put the paragraphs that are in orange, which says Okta stated does not require personal data. It's enough to just refer to their response and not to put all this in the recommendation. I don't think that this is a place for that. So, yeah. So, thank you.
Kurt, you may be on mute.
Thanks. I always say my best stuff when I'm on mute. So if I understand your statement, Hadia, you're in support of the recommendation, which is on the second page of this this document, especially continuing to pursue this during phase two, because in my personal opinion is that we need to flesh out this discussion with ICANN and its need or lack of need for data some more. So I think the specificity that Aidan's given it is good. And then just to be sure, you know, everything on the first page is not recommendation. It's sort of information that we did. It's proposed language for the final report, but this is like the introductory information that led to the recommendation. So I don't think it's harmful to say that, you know, the team reached out to ICANN and asked for this input. So that kind of gives the reason why we're putting this off to phase two is it lets us gives us time to kind of figure this conundrum out. Margie, go ahead.
Sure. I just kind of highlight some of the things in chat that we've been talking about. Sounds like Alan doesn't think that it's part of the compliance purpose for the ARF. So I think we probably need to
reinsert that, cross that language if that's the case. Obviously, this is all stuff that needs to be discussed in, you know, in phase two. And one of the recommendations I made on the list last night, I know it was late, was to say should be considered to facilitate research or threat response carried out by ICANN's office and the CTO. And again, this is not making the recommendation that it be, it's just a recommendation that it be considered in phase two, and we can, you know, dig further with ICANN as to, you know, what their needs, what they've used the data for in the past. I know what they said on the list, and I know that Alan mentioned, you know, that since, you know, since they said they haven't used it now, that it may not be necessary, but we have to really take into account what happened before May 25th, not just what the current state is, because the information is not available. So that would be my recommendation, just to have it be considered, and then we can explore those issues further in phase two.
When you said Alan, were you talking about Alan Woods or Alan Greenberg?
Yes, Alan Woods. He was mentioning about, you know, we keep talking about the OCTO answer and, you know, and their answer that they say they don't use it now, which is true because they don't have the data. But I think it's something that we should explore further in phase two.
Right. And I don't think anybody disagrees with that, I hope, and that we need to have a better discussion with OCTO if they were, you know, my reading of what they said is that we don't need personal data. So I guess that response could be interpreted as vague, and we need to flesh that out. I don't have a problem with adding the language you stated, which had to do with threats to the DNS. I don't know exactly that, but I think we're exactly where we you know, I think this is what the current recommendation says. We could add facilitate research, you know, including research having to do with and whatever Margie said about threats or risk to the DNS or however that is. If you wanted to put that language in chat, it would be great. Farzi, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to object to any addition to this purpose. It is only limited to what OCTO does, and OCTO has clearly said that it does not need personal information. Now, if they need personal information in the future, that is very speculative, and the group, I believe registrars have also said that it is speculative and they do not want something that is speculative as a to be mentioned or to be considered. If they need some data in the future, then at present the group has to decide if they want to do something about it, and I don't think that the group has consensus. And if the group also wants to use this purpose to later on just add to the laundry list of all sorts of issues that can lead to access to personal information of domain name registrants, then that's a risky and it should not happen and it should be kept limited as to OCTO's operation. It has been about that, and I don't know what is not clear about OCTO saying that they don't need personal information. It's not about they don't have access to it. It's about they do not need personal information in their work. So I think that we have to just be clear in this purpose that they do not need access to personal information. We can talk discuss later on in phase two whether we want to like consider other things, but it has to be limited to OCTO's operation. And that's it. And I will object to even having the purpose now if we just want to, if just later on there will be like issues be added to it and be broadened and then be used as like abuse of personal information of domain name registrants.
Thanks, Farzaneh. I have a comment on that and to Margie's comment too, but I want to go through the queue. Alan Woods.
Thank you very much. I'm a bit confused. I didn't actually say that ARS wasn't involved in the compliance purpose. I actually think that ARS would be for the purposes that is jointly the joint and shared purposes, or should we just say the shared purposes between the contracted parties and ICANN ARS can be used as a compliance tool. But I never said that, so apologies if I was unclear in the text of that. Just in relation to OCTO never saying or saying that they don't use it since the PDP or since the, oh good Lord, the 10 spec, that is just simply incorrect, because we specifically asked them, what did you use personal data for prior to the 10 spec? And their response on October 22nd does say that the only thing that they used before was to give training to people on how to make queries, how to identify the registrants of technical data. Clearly that they do not need to do that anymore, because, you know, this is the point of GDPR saying, you know, identification of the registrant should be on a need-to-know basis and through the proper channels. So for their research purposes, no, they never, they quite clearly limited to only one instance, and that was training. They didn't say that they needed it before, but we're completely way off point here. The fact of the matter is that Stephanie has pointed out, and I think she's, God love her, she's blue in the face from saying it in the chat at the moment, that OCTO, the research, this is ICANN's purpose alone. And if ICANN want to have a purpose, let them make the purpose, make them justify it, and figure it out. Like Margie's talking about, you know, but they don't have the data. Again, this is something that they need to deal with, but the EPDP is not the way to create this brand new purpose out of nothing. And it is a brand new purpose out of nothing. If ICANN wish to establish a purpose as controller and then want to make that part and parcel of the contracts with the contracted parties in order to transfer the data to them on a legal basis that they are going to justify as controller and us as processors, then so be it. Let them do it. Not the job of the EPDP at this particular moment in time. And I think we're wasting a whole lot of time doing this, even punting this to phase two. I think it's a huge, if they want to use it for their purpose and their purpose alone, let's remember the research is for ICANN and ICANN only, nobody else, then, you know, let them do it. They're the controllers. Let's see what they do. I mean, I don't understand why we're wasting time here.
Thanks, Alan. Hadia, go ahead.
To Alan's point, we're not creating actually any purposes. We are just recommending that we investigate such a purpose in the future. So we are not creating any purposes. It's just if you remember, this purpose was introduced, I think, in 2002, just before launching the initial report for public comment. And there was no time whatsoever to discuss it or look into it more or require information that...
Did we lose Hadia? So I guess the gods of Adobe Connect are telling us this discussion is done. So let me just reiterate a couple things. One is that you know, there are people on this team that have worked with OCTO in the past that are strongly of the opinion that there's some data processing that needs to take place. But, you know, I agree with, I don't disagree with Stephanie and Alan that ICANN really should be making this clear if they want that purpose. And So I want to go to Margie's recommendation that we include threat response. So, and then Farzaneh's response to that, and say that research and threat response are two different things. That threat response is in a one of many categories of
research. So, you know, I would be for either including threat response in this, or even making it more general. And instead of saying research by OCTO, say, you know, carried out to facilitate the mission carried out by ICANN's Office of Chief Technology Officer. So, you know, maybe we can make it more general. But having said that, you know, I don't think anybody said anything inaccurate in this discussion. So, and to the, you know, we might find ourselves discussing this in phase two if we discover additional information, or we might not. So, but I think it's important that we preserve the discussion. And so, you know, I'm for, it seemed like with Aiden's edits to the top and the bottom here that this isn't something that everyone can't live with. There's a disagreement whether we should discuss it all in phase two or not. But if some of us are strong proponents of it or not sure, then it's better to preserve that and create a record that we had this discussion of that. So it's good to know OCTO has a mission. So I would be for this. I would be for to facilitate carrying out the mission by ICANN's Office of Chief Technology Officer. I would be for making that change and taking the rest of the wording as is, including the red line. And moving forward, it's the first plus one I've gotten since like October. Yeah. So with that, let's turn it over to the ICANN support team for actions and what's next.
Thanks, Karen. This is Marika. I'm just pulling up my notes here. So there are a couple of action items that we've taken down. The first one is an extension of the deadline to flag issues for further consideration following the review of the latest version of the final report, and that's by the close of business today, Tuesday, 5th of February. Second action item is for the contracted parties to share within a maximum of 24 to 48 hours the proposed approach in relation to the implementation bridge options. Action item three is Christina to provide suggested edits to the reasonable access recommendation to ensure consistency in terminology and provide necessary clarification to facilitate implementation work. Then there's a fourth action item, action item for staff to make a note in the final report that ARS is considered covered as part of the Purpose 5 and related updates have been made in the Purpose 5 data element workbooks. And I think if I may add another action item for the group, one item that we didn't get to during today's meeting, but where we may need to come back to is the ICANN org questions. I think we did cover three of the topics that staff had at least flagged for further consideration. I think there were three others on that list. I know that the contracted parties have done some further review as well, so it would be really helpful if any other issues that need to be further considered, if those can be flagged as soon as possible, so that those can be added to the agendas for the upcoming meeting. And that's all I have.
Thank you much, Marika. I don't know if it rises to the level of an action item, but there's Aiden's intervention on the privacy proxy discussion where he wanted to replace personal data with that longer description that included or might lead to the disclosure, unintended disclosure of personal data or something like that. You know, I think that applies to more than this, that one recommendation. And I think we should write, you know, rather than a phrase, more of a paragraph about that in the in somewhere in the initial report, in the final report, in the initial stages of the final report, that this is one of our yardsticks or something like that. And then finally, you know, I just want to note that the call tomorrow will be at 1400 UTC, and I think to make it easier for one, we'll have it for like an hour and 15 minutes, and or maybe an hour and a half if the RYSG can put off their consideration of the EDP in their agenda to do that, and then we'll just call a halt to it, because I know those guys have to get on that call and talk about the stuff we talked about today. Is that it? Does anybody have any comments or questions? All right. Terrific call, everybody. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon. Hang in there.